The Spawn of Onan. A network of channel-sized air ducts as vast and unfathomable as the global internet ramifies through the thick walls and ceilings of the hotel and makes dim, attenuated noises that suggest that hidden deep within that system are jet engine proving grounds, Iron Age smithies, wretched prisoners draped with clanging chains, and writhing clumps of snakes. Randy knows that the system is not a closed loop, that it is somewhere connected to the Earth's atmosphere, because faint street smells drift in from outside. For all he knows, they may take an hour to work their way into his room. After he has been living there for a couple of weeks, the smells come to function as an olfactory alarm clock. He sleeps to the smell of diesel exhaust because the traffic conditions of Manila require that the container ships load and unload only at night. Manila sprawls along a warm and placid bay that is an infinite reservoir of mugginess, and because the atmosphere is as thick and opaque and hot as a glass of milk straight from the cow's udder, it begins to glow when the sun rises. At this, Manila's regiments and divisions of fighting cocks, imprisoned in makeshift hutches on every rooftop, balcony, and yard, begin to crow. The people come awake and begin to burn coal. Coal smoke is the smell that wakes Randy up. Randy Waterhouse is in merely decent physical condition. His doctor ritualistically tells him that he could lose 20 pounds, but it's not obvious where that 20 pounds would actually come from. He has no beer gut, no flagrant love handles. The offending pounds seem to be spread evenly over his keg-like torso. Or so he tells himself every morning, standing in front of the billboard-sized mirror of his suite. Randy and Charlene's house in California contains practically no mirrors, and he had lost track of what he looks like. Now he sees that he has become atavistically hairy, and his beard glints, because it is shot through with gray hairs. Every day he dares himself to shave that beard off. In the tropics, you want to have as much skin as possible exposed to the air, with sweat sheeting down it. One evening, when Avi and his family had been over for dinner, Randy had said, "I'm the beard, Avi's the suit," as a way of explaining their business relationship. And from that point, Charlene had been off and running. Charlene has recently finished a scholarly article deconstructing beards. In particular, she was aiming at beard culture in the Northern California high-tech community, Randy's crowd. Her paper began by demolishing, somehow, the assumption that beards were more natural or easier to maintain than clean-shavenness. She actually published statistics from Gillette's research department comparing the amount of time that bearded and beardless men spent in the bathroom each day, proving that the difference was not statistically significant. Randy had any number of objections to the way in which these statistics were gathered, but Charlene was having none of it. "It is counterintuitive," she said. She was in a big hurry to move on to the meat of her argument. She went up to San Francisco and bought a few $100s worth of pornography at a boîte that catered to shaving fetishists. For a couple of weeks, Randy couldn't come home in the evening without finding Charlene sacked out in front of the TV with a bowl of popcorn and a dictaphone, watching a video of a straight razor being drawn along wet, soapy flesh. She taped a few lengthy interviews with some actual shaving fetishists, who described in great detail the feeling of nakedness and vulnerability shaving gave them, and how erotic that was, especially when freshly shaved areas were slapped or spanked. She worked up a detailed comparison of the iconography of shaving fetishist porn and that of shaving product commercials shown on national TV during football games, and proved that they were basically indistinguishable. You could actually buy videotapes of bootleg shaving cream and razor ads in the same places that sold the out-and-out pornography. She pulled down statistics on racial variation in beard growth. American Indians didn't grow beards. Asians hardly did. Africans were a special case because daily shaving gave them a painful skin condition. "The ability to grow heavy, full beards as a matter of choice appears to be a privilege accorded by nature solely to white males," she wrote. Alarm bells, red lights, and screaming klaxons went off in Randy's mind when he happened across that phrase. "But this assertion buys into a specious subsumption. Nature is a socially constructed discourse not an objective reality. Many footnotes here. That is doubly true in the case of the nature that accords full beards to the specific minority population of northern European males. Homo sapiens evolved in climactic zones where facial hair was of little practical use. The development of an offshoot of the species characterized by densely bearded males is an adaptive response to cold climates. These climates did not naturally invade the habitats of early humans. Rather, the humans invaded geographical regions where such climates prevailed. This geographical transgression was strictly a sociocultural event, and so all physical adaptations to it must be placed in the same category, including the development of dense facial hair. Charlene published the results of a survey she had organized in which a few hundred women were asked for their opinions. Essentially, all of them said that they preferred clean-shaven men to those who were either stubbly or bearded. In short order, Charlene proved that having a beard was just one element of a syndrome strongly correlated to racist and sexist attitudes, and to the pattern of emotional unavailability so often bemoaned by the female partners of white males, especially ones who were technologically oriented. The boundary between self and environment is a social construct. In Western cultures, this boundary is supposed to be sharp and distinct. The beard is an outward symbol of that boundary, a distancing technique. To shave off the beard, or any body hair, is to symbolically annihilate the essentially specious boundary separating self from other. And so on. The paper was rapturously received by peer reviewers and immediately accepted for publication in a major international journal. Charlene is presenting some related work at the War as Text Conference, Unshavenness as Signifier in World War II Movies. On the strength of her beard work, three different Ivy League schools are fighting over who will get to hire her. Randy does not want to move to the East Coast. Worse yet, he has a full beard, which makes him feel dreadfully incorrect whenever he ventures out with her. He proposed to Charlene that perhaps he should issue a press release stating that he shaves the rest of his body every day. She did not think it was very funny. He realized, when he was halfway over the Pacific Ocean, that all of her work was basically an elaborate prophecy of the doom of their relationship. Now he is thinking of shaving his beard off. He might do his scalp and his upper body while he's at it. He is in the habit of doing a lot of vigorous walking. By the standards of the body Nazis who infest California and Seattle, this is only a marginal improvement over, say, sitting in front of a television, chain-smoking unfiltered cigarettes, and eating suet from a tub. But he has stuck to his walking doggedly while his friends have taken up fitness fads and dropped them. It has become a point of pride with him, and he's not about to stop just because he is living in Manila. But damn, it's hot. Hairlessness would be a good thing here. Only two good things came out of Randy's ill-fated first business foray with the food-gathering software. First, it scared him away from trying to do any kind of business, at least until he had the foggiest idea of what he was getting into. Second, he developed a lasting friendship with Avi, his old gaming buddy, now in Minneapolis, who displayed integrity and a good sense of humor. At the suggestion of his lawyer, who by that point was one of his major creditors, Randy declared personal bankruptcy, and then moved to Central California with Charlene. She had gotten her Ph.D. and landed a teaching assistant job at one of the three siblings. Randy enrolled at another sibling with the aim of getting his master's degree in astronomy. This made him a grad student, and grad students existed not to learn things but to relieve the tenured faculty members of tiresome burdens, such as educating people and doing research. Within a month of his arrival, Randy solved some trivial computer problems for one of the other grad students. A week later, the chairman of the astronomy department called him over and said, "So, you're the Unix guru." At the time, Randy was still stupid enough to be flattered by this attention, when he should have recognized them as bone-chilling words. 3 years later, he left the astronomy department without a degree, and with nothing to show for his labors except $600 in his bank account and a staggeringly comprehensive knowledge of Unix. Later, he was to calculate that, at the going rates for programmers, the department had extracted about $250,000 worth of work from him, in return for an outlay of less than $20,000. The only compensation was that his knowledge didn't seem so useless anymore. Astronomy had become a highly networked discipline, and you could now control a telescope on another continent or in orbit by typing commands into your keyboard, watching the images it produced on your monitor. Randy was now superbly knowledgeable when it came to networks. Years ago, this would have been of limited usefulness. But this was the age of networked applications, the dawn of the World Wide Web, and the timing couldn't have been better. In the meantime, Avi had moved to San Francisco and started a new company that was going to take role-playing games out of the nerd ghetto and make them mainstream. Randy signed on as the head technologist. He tried to recruit Chester, but he'd already taken a job with a software company back up in Seattle. So they brought in a guy who had worked for a few video game companies, and later they brought in some other guys to do hardware and communications, and they raised enough seed money to build a playable prototype. Using that as their dog and pony show, they went down to Hollywood and found someone to back them to the tune of $10 million. They rented out some industrial space in Gilroy, filled it full of graphics workstations, hired a lot of sharp programmers and a few artists, and went to work. 6 months later, they were frequently mentioned as among Silicon Valley's rising stars, and Randy got a little photograph in Time magazine in an article about Silliwood, the growing collaboration between Silicon Valley and Hollywood. A year after that, the entire enterprise had crashed and burned. This was an epic tale not worth telling. The conventional wisdom, circa the early 90s, had been that the technical wizards of Northern California would meet the creative minds of Southern California halfway and create a brilliant new collaboration. But this was rooted in a naive view of what Hollywood was all about. Hollywood was merely a specialized bank, a consortium of large financial entities that hired talent, almost always for a flat rate, ordered that talent to create a product, and then marketed that product to death all over the world in every conceivable medium. The goal was to find products that would keep on making money forever, long after the talent had been paid off and sent packing. Casablanca, for example, was still putting asses in seats decades after Bogart had been paid off and smoked himself into an early grave. In the view of Hollywood, the techies of Silicon Valley were just a particularly naive form of talent. So when the technology reached a certain point, the point where it could be marketed to a certain large Nipponese electronics company at a substantial profit, the backers of Avi's company staged a lightning coup that had obviously been lovingly planned. Randy and the others were given a choice. They could leave the company now and hold on to some of their stock, which was still worth a decent amount of money. Or they could stay, in which case they would find themselves sabotaged from within by fifth columnists who had been infiltrated into key positions. At the same time, they would be besieged from without by lawyers demanding their heads for the things that were suddenly going wrong. Some of the founders stayed on as court eunuchs. Most of them left the company, and of that group, most sold their stock immediately because they could see it was going nowhere but down. The company was gutted by the transfer of its technology to Japan, and the empty husk eventually dried up and blew away. Even today, bits and pieces of the technology keep popping up in the oddest places, such as advertisements for new video game platforms. It always gives Randy the creeps to see this. When it all started to go wrong, the Nipponese tried to hire him directly, and he actually made some money flying over there to work, for a week or a month at a time, as a consultant. But they couldn't keep the technology running with the programmers they had, and so it hasn't lived up to its potential. Thus ended Randy's second business foray. He came out of it with a couple of $100,000, most of which he plowed into the Victorian house he shares with Charlene. He hadn't trusted himself with that much liquid cash, and locking it up in the house gave him a feeling of safety, like reaching home base in a frenzied game of full-contact tag. He has spent the years since running the three siblings' computer system. He hasn't made much money, but he hasn't had much stress either. Randy was forever telling people, without rancor, that they were full of shit. That was the only way to get anything done in hacking. No one took it personally. Charlene's crowd most definitely did take it personally. It wasn't being told that they were wrong that offended them, though. It was the underlying assumption that a person could be right or wrong about anything. So on the night in question, the night of Abby's fateful call, Randy had done what he usually did, which was to withdraw from the conversation. In the Tolkien, not the endocrinological or Snow White sense, Randy is a dwarf. Tolkien's dwarves were stout, taciturn, vaguely magical characters who spent a lot of time in the dark hammering out beautiful things, for example, rings of power. Thinking of himself as a dwarf who had hung up his axe for a while to go sojourning in the Shire, where he was surrounded by squabbling hobbits, that is, Charlene's friends, had actually done a lot for Randy's peace of mind over the years. He knew perfectly well that if he were stuck in academia, these people and the things they said would seem momentous to him. But where he came from, nobody had been taking these people seriously for years. So he just withdrew from the conversation and drank his wine and looked out over the Pacific surf and tried not to do anything really obvious like shaking his head and rolling his eyes. Then the topic of the information superhighway came up, and Randy could feel faces turning in his direction like searchlights, casting almost palpable warmth on his skin. The government has set up glass display cases in the concourse leading from passport control to the security barrier. The cases contain artifacts demonstrating the glories of pre-Magellan Filipino culture. The first one of these containers, the pièce de résistance, a rustic hand-carved musical instrument labeled with a long and unreadable name in Tagalog. Underneath that, in smaller letters, is the English translation, one-note flute.
"See, the Philippines is innately hedged," Avi said. "You know how rare that is? When you find an innately hedged environment, Randy, you lunge into it like a rabid ferret going into a pipe full of raw meat."
A word about Avi. His father's people had just barely gotten out of Prague. As Central European Jews went, they were fairly typical. The only thing about them that was really anomalous was that they were still alive. But his mother's people were unbelievably peculiar New Mexican crypto-Jews who had been living on mesas, dodging Jesuits, shooting rattlesnakes and eating jimson weed for 300 years. They looked like Indians and talked like cowboys. In his relations with other people, therefore, Abby dithered. Most of the time, he was courtly and correct in a way that was deeply impressive to business people, Nipponese ones especially. But there were these eruptions from time to time, as if he'd been dipping into the loco weed. Randy had learned to deal with it, which is why Abby called him at times like this.
"Oh, calm down," Randy said.
He watched a tanned girl rollerblade past him on her way up from the beach.
"Innately hedged?"
"As long as the Philippines don't have their shit together, there'll be plenty of OCWs. They will want to communicate with their families. The Filipinos are incredibly family-oriented. They make Jews look like a bunch of alienated loners."
"Okay, you know more about both groups than I do."
"They are sentimental and affectionate in a way that's very easy for us to sneer at."
"You don't have to be defensive," Randy said. "I'm not sneering at them."
"When you hear their song dedications on the radio, you'll sneer," Abby said. "But frankly, we could take some pointers from the Pinoys on this front."
"You are so close to being sanctimonious right now."
"I apologize," Abby said, with absolute sincerity.
Avi's wife had been pregnant almost continuously for the 4 years they'd been married. He was getting more religiously observant daily and couldn't make it through a conversation without mentioning the Holocaust. Randy was a bachelor who was just about to break up with the chick he'd been living with.
"I believe you, Avi," Randy said. "Is it a problem with you if I buy a business class ticket?"
Avi didn't hear him, so Randy assumed that meant yes.
"As long as that's the case, there will be a big market for Pinoygrams."
"Pinoygrams?"
"For God's sake, don't say it out loud! I'm filling out the trademark applications as we speak,"
Abby said. Randy could hear a rattling sound in the background, computer keys impacting so rapidly it sounded like Abby was simply holding the keyboard between his pale, spindly hands and shaking it violently up and down.
"But if the Filipinos do get their shit together, then we see explosive growth in telecoms as in any other R-Day."
"R-Day?"
RDAE, Rapidly Developing Asian Economy. "Either way, we win."
I gather you want to do something with telecoms.
Bingo! In the background, a baby began to cough and cry. Gotta go, Abby said. Shlomo's asthma is spiking again. Take down this fingerprint.
Fingerprint?
For my encryption key. For email?
Ordo?
Yeah.
Randy took out a ballpoint pen and, finding no paper in his pocket, poised it over the palm of his hand.
Shoot.
6781A4AEFF40259B43 0E298D5660E32F.
Then Abby hung up the phone. Randy went back into the restaurant. On his way back, he asked the waiter to bring him a half bottle of good red wine. Charlene heard him and glowered. Randy was still thinking about innate ferocity and did not see it in her face. Only a school marmishness common among all her friends. My God, I have to get out of California, he realized.